Okay, so our next topic is on microinsurance. Presenting will be Jin Chen and Keith Mberengwa. Jin Chen is a senior actuarial analyst in the general insurance team at Deloitte Actuarial and Insurance Solutions based in Johannesburg. She graduated from Wits University in 2019 with an honors degree in actuarial science and has been working in the general insurance consulting industry for the past 3.5 years. She's worked as part of the first line actuarial team of a microinsurer for the past 3 years. She's also part of the microinsurance research subcommittee. And then Keith is a senior actuarial analyst in the general insurance team at Deloitte Actuarial and Insured Solutions based in Johannesburg. He graduated from Wits University in 2017 with a degree in actuarial science and has been working in the market research, life insurance, and general insurance consulting industry for the past 5.5 years. Thank you.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Ting, and I'm joined by my colleague Keith, and today we will be discussing how you can microwave hello to microinsurance. On our agenda today, we will be discussing the background of microinsurance, so looking at what is microinsurance. We'll cover product design and regulation and compliance. We'll take an overview of a comparison between microinsurance license versus a traditional insurance license. We'll have an overview of the microinsurance markets in South Africa and looking at whether there are any opportunities for insurers, some practical considerations, and we'll end off with a high-level industry review. So let's discuss the background of microinsurance. What is microinsurance? The Insurance Act of 2017 defines a microinsurer as an insurer that's licensed to conduct microinsurer's business. The aim is to provide insurance that is accessible to and accessible by the low-income population. Now, a microinsurer is able to write both life and non-life business, subject to the specified lines of business. The Insurance Act also prescribes the maximum amounts that the insurance policy can cover. So that's 100,000 Rand for life insurance and 300,000 Rand for non-life insurers. And that's CPI index from 2017. The aim of the product design for microinsurance policies is that they're not so complex such that it increases the risk for the microinsurer or for the policyholders. We can see here that the list of lines of business for non-life insurance is considerably simplified compared to what you would expect to see for a short-term insurer. From this table, we can see only personal lines and non-complex reinsurance that is being sold. I think personal lines crop is an interesting one because you would associate crop business with fields and fields of farmlands, and you would expect to see very large sum insureds. Another interesting one is personal lines pet insurance. And what we're seeing in motor personal lines is roadside assistant type of products emerging in the market. Here we can see the prescribed lines of business for life insurance, also considerably simplified. Life, credit life, and funeral are all still being able to sold on a group basis. We can also see that health and disability are still sold, and benefits can be paid on a recurring payment or a lump sum benefit. Now, since microinsurance allows an insurer to write both life and non-life business, we see combinations such as credit life and consumer credit emerging in the industry. I'll run through some other elements of product design here. So, firstly, a policy cannot have a contract term that is more than 12 months. If the policy has an excess, it may not exceed the lower of 10% of the value of the total obligation or 1,000 Rand. Commission across all microinsurance products are uncapped except for credit life products. Claims must be finalized within 2 business days after all required documentation is received. Products are limited to risk-only benefits, so that means no premium rebates unless explicitly approved by the regulator. There are no surrender or investment values, no loyalty benefits, and no claims bonuses. Rider benefits must be less than 20% of the total obligation, and there are no exclusions on pre-existing conditions on funeral products. This list is not exhaustive. So the final section of the background of microinsurance will be discussing regulation and compliance. Now, for short-term insurance, we know that there are the FSIs and the GOIs. But for microinsurance, we have the FSMs and the GOMs. So that's the financial soundness for microinsurers and the governance and operational standards for microinsurance. Unlike the FSIs, there are only two FSMs, which comprises the prescribed formulae to determine your TPs, your own funds, and your capital requirements. We will discuss the specific solvency requirement calculations later on in a section through an illustrative example. The FSMs also cap the amount of assets that can be held in any one institution, with this cap being 25% of the total liabilities, net of reinsurance, and including the capital requirement. The FSMs also prescribe the specific assets that a microinsurer is allowed to invest in, with these being cash and cash equivalents or investment funds restricted to money market funds. Now, a microinsurer is allowed to apply to the PA to get a special dispensation to allow other types of assets to be admissible, such as your government bonds or floating rate notes. If this if they get this approval, the PA would require them to hold an additional capital add-on. And the methodology to determine this additional capital add-on would be prescribed by the PA on a case-by-case basis. And finally, similar to all the other insurers, a microinsurer has to submit a quarterly and annual QRT, an annual QRR, and an ORSA to the PA. Now we're going to cover the similarities and differences between a microinsurance license and a traditional insurance license. First, let's look at the similarities. Audit requirements, licensing process, and the access to brokers and reinsurance markets are all comparable to a traditional insurer. The differences here are HAF requirements, admissible assets, capital requirements, and when it comes to reinsurance, a microinsurer has limited negotiation power given its limited scale. Now, we've already covered the admissible assets on the previous slide, so let's delve into the HAF requirements in more detail. The GOMs has simplified the HAF requirements noted under GOI 3, but most of the same HAF requirements from paragraph 14 of GOI 3 still apply, and we also note that the microinsurer is still required to be included in a group QRT review. So what has been simplified? The HAF no longer has to perform a policy review. They do not have to perform any dividend reviews unless it pertains to the ORSA. And finally, there is no RI adequacy review. My colleague Keith will now take you through the solvency requirement calculations.
Thank you, Ting. Gosh, scary up here. Guess there's no turning back. Okay. So let us have a look at the differences in capital requirements between a traditional insurer and a microinsurer. What we have above here is your usual SCR framework that we all know under SAM, and this is what it looks like as an MCR framework under microinsurance. Less complicated, right? Well, microinsurers are only required to hold a 4 million rand upfront capital compared to the 15 million rand that is required for traditional insurance. And they are also required to only hold an MCR. Now, while traditional insurers are required to calculate their SCR as usual under SAM, microinsurers do not need to hold any operational risk, they don't need any participation risk, no basic solvency for capital requirement, and no adjustment factor for deferred taxes. The PA only requires a minimum capital requirement of 15% of net written premiums, with an absolute minimum capital requirement of 4 million for microinsurers. Sorry. Now, in the absence of capital add-on, our MCR is pretty much equal to our SCR. Now, let us consider an illustrative example. So we're going to have a hypothetical short-term insurer that has been operating under a traditional license and now has transitioned to starting to operate under a microinsurer, under a microinsurance license. But firstly, let's come up with some very, very simplified assumptions for our illustration. So firstly, let's assume that this business is equally written between credit life and consumer credit. It's a monthly business, incepting at the start of each month, so there's no need for us to hold UPR. There's no reinsurance. The 2023 GWP is going to be 100 million, and the 2022 GWP is going to be 90 million. Now, looking at our total assets, we are going to hold one South African government bond at 100 million, three FRNs that are issued by three different South African banks at 10 million rand each. We have cash in one of the South African banks at 50 million rand, deferred tax assets sitting at 20 million rand, 100 million owners occupied property, and no debtors. Now, looking at our total liabilities, we're going to have discounted IFRS TPs that are 10 million rand held at best estimate. We're also going to have other liabilities at 50 million rand and no OCR for liabilities. So, let's have a deeper look into our TPs. Considering the simplified assumptions that I've made in the previous slide, our illustration is only going to focus on the IBNR reserve. So, under the traditional insurance license, we'd usually change our TPs from an IFRS basis to a SAM basis by first applying discounting and then removing margins. This isn't required under microinsurance. Since our IFRS TPs are already discounted and at best estimate based on the assumptions that I made, in this situation, our IFRS TPs are just going to be equal to our SAM TPs. So, the resulting TPs that was calculated for a traditional insurer using a triangulation method in this particular example resulted in an IBNR reserve that is equal to 10% of net written premiums. Well, under the microinsurance license, the PA prescribes that we must hold a 7% for IBNR, a 7% factor to the net written premiums for IBNR. So, as a result, the IBNR reserve that is going to be held under insurer is much less than the one that is going to be held under a traditional insurer. Anyways, so above what we have here is the same balance sheet that is looking at a comparison of a microinsurer and a traditional insurer. Now, the government bonds of 100 million that we have under a traditional insurer are assumed to be disclosed under cash and deposits under microinsurance license. There's also no deferred tax assets held under microinsurance. Now, as a result, we're going to have lower total assets that are held under microinsurer compared to the ones that are held under a traditional insurer. Now, for illustrative disclosure purposes, we've assumed that all these assets have been granted by the PA. This is something that I'll be touching on later on in my presentation. Now, looking at the liabilities, as I mentioned before, the triangulation method under the traditional license resulted in an IBNR reserve that was 10% of net written premiums. This is simply higher than the 7% that is prescribed by the PA. It is very important for us to understand that this is only specific to this particular example. It's not always the norm. We have seen instances where the actual calculated IBNR under a traditional insurance license is much less than the prescribed 7%. So, the microinsurance total liabilities, together with the assets net of liabilities under a microinsurer, are much less than those under a traditional insurer. Now, with the absence of the market risk and non-life underwriting, together with our assets being limited to cash and cash equivalents, and our investment funds being invested in the money market instrument, the microinsurance MCR is less than the traditional insurance MCR and SCR. Now, this MCR from the microinsurance is calculated using a PA-prescribed formula. For ease, we have assumed that there was not going to be any LAC-DT in this illustration. Now, Let's have a look at the asset spreading adjustment. So in the event that the insurer converts to microinsurance without the PA's approval for a special dispensation to allow other types of assets to be admissible, this is what the position looks like. With one government bond, three FRNs, and cash in bank, we have our total assets sitting at 180 million. With a 25% cap applied to the total liabilities, our total admissible assets are 25.5 million. Now, as per the FSM2, the 25% cap is applied to the total liabilities of 102 million, which creates a maximum limit of 25.5 million. Now, the sum of each asset that exceeds this limit makes up the asset spreading adjustment of 154.5 million. In this case, the only asset that we're looking at is cash in bank. So, as my colleague Ting mentioned, a microinsurer is able to apply to the PA for a special dispensation to allow other types of assets to be admissible, such as government bonds and FRNs. Now, in the event that the traditional insurer converts to a microinsurance license with the approval from the PA to, one, allow government bonds to be admissible, two, allow FRNs to be admissible, and three, increase the cap of the assets from 25% to 100% of the total liabilities and capital add-on requirements. The following occurs. The microinsurer is now required to hold an additional capital add-on to allow for the additional risks taken on to invest in these assets. We worked out this capital add-on to be 10.8 million, which is added to the MCR to come up with an SCR of 25.8 million. I'm happy to discuss our approach to those figures after this presentation. Now, following the approval from the PA to invest in the government bonds and FRNs, this insurer's asset spreading adjustment decreased to zero. The inclusion of a capital add-on increased the total liabilities, and an increase in cap from 25% to 100% means that the value of the assets that actually exceed this cap were much less. So this, together with the limitations from the liabilities, resulted in a reduction in asset spreading adjustment. In this case, because no asset actually breached this limit, our asset spreading adjustment was zero. Now, the table above summarizes all our findings. The solvency cover ratio in the absence of the PA approval for other admissible assets slightly increased, but then increased quite significantly with the special dispensation. In the interest of time, we're also not going to delve deep into how we calculated these numbers during the presentation, but it's also something that my colleague and I can discuss after this. Now, as I mentioned earlier, the absence of deferred tax assets under microinsurer has resulted in a reduction in total assets compared to what we have for a traditional insurer. Also, the triangulation method in this example did result in higher TPs compared to the prescribed 7% that is used for microinsurance. So our liabilities decreased. Our basic on funds decreased slightly, and this is mainly driven by the decrease in the assets that I touched on earlier. Now, our asset spreading adjustment is quite large in the absence of the PA's approval on admissible assets. Given the approval for the special dispensation from the PA, the asset spreading adjustment is zero, considering that no assets breached the limit that we calculated. Sorry. Also, the introduction of an asset spreading adjustment has significantly reduced the eligible on funds in the absence of the PA's approval. With the PA's approval on admissible assets, the eligible on funds increased quite significantly to 193 million. So, both the solvency cover ratio and the excess capital have increased under the microinsurance license in the presence of a special dispensation. I'm now just going to give everyone a minute to just have a look at the numbers and allow myself to breathe a little bit also. Thank you. On to less numbers. Let us have a look at the overview of the microinsurance market in South Africa. So, we currently have 16 ASA registered PC holders in the country. These have grown from there being 9 in 2019, reflecting the significant growth that is happening in this industry. An interesting fact, you can actually be an ASA PC holder as an AMASA. All you have to do is pass at least one of your F100s and make sure that you've got at least 5 years work experience with three of those working under a HAF. There are currently 17 existing microinsurance licenses in South Africa, with 24% of these being composite, which is a hybrid of life and short-term, and then 76% of them being life. Four licenses have been rejected by the PA between 2022 and 2023, and as of today, there's 7 licenses that are currently in progress, in the application process at least. We have seen a significant growth in the microinsurance space over the past 5 years. Since the launch of this license in 2019, the number of microinsurance licenses has increased from 2 to 17. So the question that we have is there an exploitative space for short-term insurers in the microinsurance space? Now, South Africa has one of the highest unemployment and inequality rates, so most people simply cannot afford traditional insurance products anymore. Hence, there is a huge market for microinsurers to tap into. Corporate social responsibility can also occur in much innovative ways, such as producing products that are innovative and affordable as those that are offered under a microinsurance license. Sun Life and life insurers have an opportunity to also construct hybrid products that can be that gives them opportunity to tap into each other's markets. So, the answer is yes. Both short-term and life insurers have an opportunity to tap into each other's markets through microinsurance licenses. So now, let us have a look at some practical considerations. So, what are some of the key questions to start asking yourself if you're considering microinsurance? With IFRS 17 coming into play, if SAM and IFRS TP method, if your SAM and IFRS TP methodologies are not aligned, there's a need to probably maintain two separate IBNR workings. It's probably important to ask yourself what type of products work under microinsurance license. I mean, in funeral, we have life, but what about in short term? Also, is there an opportunity to write standalone microinsurance business in an already highly competitive short-term insurance space? I mean, maybe consumer credit. Of course, the majority of people in South Africa have become very comfortable with buying their products on credit, right? But there's also an issue. There's also the issue of moral hazard. I mean, if most people already know that they are insured on the goods that they bought on credit, they'll probably lose any incentive to actually protect and take care of these products. Lastly, how flexible do you actually want your business to be? Do you want it to be a 3-year business or a 10-year business maybe? And lastly, do you have enough information about the target market? Well, our industry review following multiple discussions with a number of microinsurers has provided us insight into most of those questions. So we're going to have a look at the industry review. And I'm going to ask my colleague Ting a couple of questions. So Ting, tell us, why transition from a traditional insurance license to a microinsurance license?
Don't worry, guys. I already know the answers. The simple answer is that it allows you to write composite business. So you avoid having to have two different insurance companies in a group. So that means you avoid the two of everything. Two audit fees, two audit committees, two board of directors, etc. And it's simple and easy to understand business.
Oh, sorry. Well, clearly I don't know the answers. Okay, Ting, maybe you can touch more on the target market in South Africa.
We're looking at regional and rural South Africa. So that's your mechanics, your plumbers, your domestic workers, your general workers, your school teachers, and even your government workers in urban areas.
Would you consider microinsurance to be a space where intensive advertisement is required?
We probably expect very minimal advertising, so posters or in-store brochures, SMSs and calls to policyholders. There's definitely a potential for social media advertising, but I think the aim is to really keep the advertising costs at a minimum.
Okay, Ting, that's quite interesting. So what are some of the cost benefits that you think are there in microinsurance?
As we've discussed, there are cheaper and less onerous solvency calculations. We have the potential for less onerous TPs and MCR or MCR. However, the audit costs are still the same, but they are limited underwriting, so there's limited underwriting costs. And finally, the microinsurance styles are generally cheaper to set up. I'm tired of answering questions. Keith, let me ask you the questions. What unexpected business operations can there be?
Well, Ting, the FSM weddings are subject. Guys, I actually do not know the answers. I'm joking, but yeah. So the FSM weddings are subject to interpretation, especially around the 7% IBNR. And also, when it comes to tax, there is a bit of a complication there. I mean, the SARS guidance for microinsurers has not yet been finalized. There's also really high claims management expenses. Some policyholders are really, really in rural parts of South Africa, which makes it very difficult to obtain supporting documents. And there's also like a huge cost for insurers now to actually assist some of those policyholders in submitting claims. For instance, there's an insurer that we know that actually provides transport to those policyholders from their rural homes to police stations as part of like the inception of the claim process. I think that's about it. Let me see. So there's also the intermediaries are really struggling with this 48 short window period that they need to pretty much bring out the claims to the insurers. And lastly, staff are quite strained with a very short turnaround time. And lastly, there is potential for, especially in the funeral space, there is potential for some of those products to have very long-term contract boundaries, which means in IFRS 17, they'll be now be forced to be modeled under GMM, which is way more complex than the usual PAA that we would do for like 12-month products.
Yeah, which kind of negates the simplicity that microinsurance offers.
Exactly, Ting.
Are microinsurance products growing for the current businesses?
Well, Ting, there is definitely a growing customer base. And also there's like some really, really impressive new products that are being released so far. We've also seen a whole number of short-term insurers transition from short-term to microinsurance, especially because of the less onerous capital requirements that are there. But we're also seeing quite a huge influx of actual life insurers transitioning also to microinsurance, mainly because they want to sell their funeral products there. Unfortunately, also, this issue around the 7% IBNR reserve is quite unattractive to insurers, especially those insurers that have very low sum assured. I mean, some of them we've seen when they do their triangulation methods, they actually get almost negligible IBNR reserve. So this becomes very difficult for them to accept a 7% IBNR when their calculations require zero or almost zero IBNR reserve.
So then what are the benefits to the policyholders?
There is a cost-saving benefit that the insurers are experiencing, right, considering the less stringent requirements that are there on microinsurers. So this cost-saving is obviously filtering to the products that are being sold to the policyholders. Also, these products are really, really simple and easy to understand for almost anyone. I mean, there's also an idea that you can actually exclude the principle of averaging when it comes to microinsurance. The other thing I would say is, it's a bit of a stretch, but considering that, you know, a particular policyholder that would have a composite microinsurance product, they would only experience one debit order fee if their debit order was to bonds. Let's say, take for example, most of these people, obviously, they're not as well off, so there's potential for such events to occur. But if they have, two separate policies, one in life and one in short. In short term, they're obviously experiencing double debit order fees every single time, and those things can accumulate. Now, the other thing is there's very short waiting periods to service policy holders. And lastly, there is limited underwriting when it comes to microinsurance.
Thank you, Keith. That was very insightful. And thank you to everyone for listening. We're happy to take any questions.
Okay, we do have one or two questions online, but once again, if there's anyone in the room with a question, let's start there.
Thank you for that presentation. Just a super easy question. Is there any legal requirement to present yourself as a microinsurer to policyholders and the public, or can you advertise as an insurer? And is there also any legal requirement to explain the difference to them?
Not that we know of. I don't think there is a legal requirement to disclose that you are a microinsurer. I think you can just define yourself as an insurer if you want to, or a microinsurer. Either ways works.
Yeah, but so to add on to that, I don't think you're able to sell microinsurance products unless you're licensed as a microinsurer. So if you're already licensed as a microinsurer, you would expect your potential policyholders coming to you to know that you are a microinsurer.
Any more questions in the room? The one online question was regarding why the commission is uncapped, and does that not defeat the points?
I don't know the answer to that one. I think it's I think it's probably something that's just prescribed in the Insurance Act.
The other one is, in your view, is microinsurance actually a viable or sustainable business in South Africa, given the extreme poverty of the targeted market?
I think that's a very, very interesting question, and it's a question that we also asked ourselves in terms of how can you be fair to people with a low disposable income to ask them to purchase insurance that maybe they don't need. But I think if you're offering something that... this is, I guess, a personal belief of what insurance is trying to do is to provide you that comfort around any uncertainty in your life, right? And if you look at funeral products in particular, in South Africa, there's a large cultural background of having big funerals and sending people off correctly in terms of, you know, how they have grown up and stuff. And so funeral products have really bloomed in the microinsurance space. So when it comes to other products, and this is the question that we're trying to ask, is what kind of products can we offer as a short-term industry, is what products can we offer that also meets that need for this low-income population?
Thank you.
It's just a silly question. I wanted to ask, since you mentioned that microinsurance products can only be written for a max of like 12 months. So since they offer both life and non-life business, so are all the life products just subjected to like the 12 months? So are we only going to have like funeral products, and what about the other ones?
That's correct. So we are limited to 12 months, which means you can only write, whether it's life or short-term business, you can only write business that is going to be limited to that space. So the idea behind microinsurance is obviously to target the sort of like people with less financial backing compared to what most people would get from a traditional space. So it's to create very simplified products that are easily affordable and that are also within a very short space of time, if I can put it that way. So 12 months in your case.
I also feel like not having super great experience with life products, I don't know how they try to model like longer term policies with that limitation. So I can get back to you on that.
You mentioned that there's, if FSMs and GOMs, which are separate to the FSRs, are there also perhaps different TCF and PRR, more conduct regulations that are separate for microinsurers? Are they identical to normal insurers?
I don't think so. Yeah, I don't think that's true.
Thank you.
It's another question online, just to say, since the products will be aimed at lower LSMs, do you expect the same level of insurance familiarity as the current target markets, that lower marketing and or acquisition costs can be expected and justified? If the segment is looking for value for money products, would there not be a need to create more tangible benefits if no claims are made through VAS offerings, negating any potential cost savings?
Yes. No, I think that's an excellent point. I guess it also it speaks to that point on one insurer having to go through more effort in trying to obtain the supporting documents. So in the same vein, I would expect insurers trying to provide more information to their potential policyholders in order to be fair. Yeah.
Thank you. All right, I think we're out of time. So thanks, Ting. Thanks, Keith.